Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. On this edition of PTR, the Department of Justice has announced its radical reorganization and reorientation of the FBI. We'll look at some of the history of the U.S. criminal justice system and how the system changes in order to maintain control over the masses.
We talked about the 1994 crime bill following the L.A. Rebellion, comparably so back in the 1880s and 1890s. It's no accident that these three strike statutes were passed, that the rise of the modern police force began to happen. It happened at a time when this country, and the world for that matter, were undergoing a tremendous change in the organization of the economy. The rulers in this country had to deal with that. These laws reflect prevention. And what's it preventing? It's not only preventing criminal behavior, but it's preventing dissent.
Despite that, activists have come together to fight against a proposed so-called super jail in Alameda County, California.
This is definitely the first time that the five organizations, the national organizations that are online here, are all together speaking out against the proposed construction of a huge detention center in one county.
Youth Force, in conjunction with Books Not Bars, have organized hundreds of youth who are directly affected by the hall, and we've sent a clear message to the county that we don't need a 540-bed facility. Instead, we want youth services that are community-based. We want rebuilt and expanded schools. We want job training programs. We want alternatives to detention that meet our needs. Alameda County has tried to turn a deaf ear towards us, but the youth of the Bay Area are organized, mobilized, educated, and committed to stopping the misguided expansion of the juvenile hall.
And we have a special encore presentation of our interview with Guillermo Gomez Peña.
Criminal identity profile. Complete name, Guillermo Lino Gomez Peña. English translation, Guermo, Chiwermo, Williermo, Gomez Pinis, or Piña. Nationality, since 1999, dual, Mexican and USian. Self-identity, transgenic Mexican in process of Chicanoization. Race, genetically engineered mestizo. Languages spoken fluently: Spanish, English, Spanglish, Gringoñol, Franglais, Robo Esperanto, and Fake Nahuatl. Distinguishing features: performance scars on both arms, stomach, and right knee, pinto tattoos on chest, right arm, and left shoulder, Chicano astigmatas on my back, hyper-Mexican mustache, loungy sideburns, melancholic gaze. Occupations: performance artist, writer, videoasta, journalist, activist, borderologo, reversed anthropologist, experimental linguist, media pirate, bad actor, Latino consumer service representative of the U.S. art world, and understudy for Mr. Antonio Banderas.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also published the bilingual newspaper, People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. In 1991, after an automobile chase, Los Angeles police pulled over their suspect, Rodney King. As happens in most urban areas on an almost nightly basis, the police began viciously beating and abusing their detainee, kicking him and swinging their batons like baseball bats. What was unusual in this case was that a nearby resident videotaped the beating, and it was shown on TV across the country. Confronted with such damning evidence, L.A. was forced to charge the officers with police brutality. The subsequent trial was moved out of Los Angeles to Simi Valley, and on April 29, 1992, the jurors returned a verdict of not guilty. The not guilty verdict set off 6 days of rebellion, and in the end, 50 people were left dead, more than 2,300 wounded, 17,000 people had been arrested, and there was over $1 billion in property damage. While many government officials attempted to paint the 1992 Los Angeles Rebellion as a race riot, this is far from an accurate description of what actually happened. Far from simply being a black uprising, the rebellion was led by the permanently and marginally unemployed deployed of all colors. The unity of action of white, black, and Latinos reached an unprecedented level. This time, African Americans did not stand alone in their fight against the state. The late 1980s saw the reorganization of industrial production throughout the world. From the Rust Belt to the industrial heart of Los Angeles, hundreds of factories were shut down as corporations went in search of cheaper labor. Poignantly, the L.A. Rebellion caught fire in the neighborhoods which were driven into poverty as thousands of families faced unemployment. By finding the officers not guilty, the jury virtually legalized police brutality. The rebellion was a clear statement by the newly disenfranchised sections of society that they too had an agenda. That agenda was summed up in the slogan, "No justice, no peace." The people in many of LA's neighborhoods had long been aware that the police were the shock troops being used in a war against the poor. But the LA rebellion was also a wake-up call for the ruling class, and they soon took steps to curtail any social struggle. Ed Oasa is a private investigator from California's Bay Area. He works primarily for attorneys engaged in criminal defense with an emphasis on death penalty cases. He was interviewed by People's Tribune radio correspondent Steve Miller. Ed Oasa.
The LA Rebellion occurred in 1992. In a matter of 2 years, the Clinton administration came out with its 1994 crime bill. The cornerstone of that bill was the three strikes law. I think it's no accident that that law was passed in the aftermath of a very serious rebellion from the standpoint of the rulers in this country. Following the 1994 crime bill, we have yet another bill that was called the Anti-Terrorist Bill in 1996. Again, the cornerstone of that was the further undermining of a basic constitutional right that all of us have. And it's like a last appeal for us called the writ of habeas corpus. What that bill did was really make it very, very difficult for any of us or a prisoner to appeal his or her conviction and question his or her detainment in a state or federal prison. The writ of habeas corpus is submitted post-trial period, post-verdict period. And that is based upon the generation of new evidence that was not, for whatever reason, was not presented at trial. This process is very long. The habeas investigations require enormous amount of time. This takes years, could be years of investigation into the appellant's or the prisoner's family history, social history. What that 1996 bill did was to undermine a person's right to generate new evidence that might well overturn a sentence.
Habeas corpus is what the boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter used to finally get out of prison.
You mentioned Reuben Hurricane Carter. I heard him speak at the death penalty conference, the annual death penalty conference in Monterey, California. This was maybe 5-6 years ago, and He calls for a legal movement to maintain our right, our constitutional right to the writ of habeas corpus. Carter used it, and it took years. What the 96 crime bill does, from my understanding, the appellant has 1 year, 12 meager months to submit his writ of habeas corpus, and that 1 year follows the decision of the appeal. When you hear the word appeal, the appeal just applies to what happens at trial. It does not have to do with new evidence. Once the appeal decision is made, then the appellant has 12 months to submit a writ of habeas corpus. I've heard talk among criminal defense attorneys that with this one-year standard in federal law, this means that conceivably an appellant will not be able to complete his state habeas corpus writ in time, you know, before a federal writ. So an appellant then loses out one whole stage of appeal because of this time limit that came down in the 1996 crime bill.
Ed, you talked about the two laws that were passed post, the first was post the Los Angeles Rebellion in 92, and the second was post the Oklahoma City bombing. But since we had the 9-1-1 incidents in New York and in Washington, the Patriot Act has been passed. How is this different than the first two laws that you were discussing?
The USA Patriot Act, passed last year, is a marked departure from not only the 1994 crime bill and the 1996 anti-terrorist bill. These bills deal with what is. Now, let me explain that. This country has a long history of dealing with crime in terms of law enforcement, right? And what I mean by that is it has to do with enforcing the law. It has to do with punishing and sentencing. Right? Even if you take all of these acts and experiences over the years to try and deal with criminal behavior, including our the American experience with COINTELPRO, the war on drugs, and these recent bills, except for the USA Patriot Act. They deal with undermining, disrupting movements on the part of the poor, protest movements, civil rights movements. These acts did not deal with prevention. The 1994 crime bill does not deal with prevention. It dealt with sentencing and punishment with the hope that the stiffer sentences will lead to a deterrence in crime. That, of course, has not happened. Even so, the 1996 anti-terrorist bill, with its evisceration of habeas corpus, still deals with sentencing and punishment. This 2002 bill deals with prevention. It is a merger of the Foreign Intelligence Act with law enforcement. It strives to prevent crime, and this opens the door for all the legislation we've seen in the last year regarding wiretapping, the listening in on attorney-client conversations, and what have you. The game now is not simply law enforcement and punishment. The game now is prevention.
How does the prevention tie in with the historic rights people have had to due process?
This act, the 2002 USA Patriot Act, it really comes down to an attack on constitutional rights. I mean, this is a continuation now, but really, and also an abrupt break. It's a continuation of the process set in motion by the Clinton administration with the attack on a constitutional right, our constitutional right on habeas corpus. But the 2002 Patriot Act carries it further, and it attacks our Fourth Amendment, which is our right to reasonable search and seizures. It attacks our Fifth Amendment rights, which is our right to not incriminate ourselves. And it attacks the 14th Amendment, which is the right to a due process. Now, I'll give you a little example of this. Just the other day, I was talking to an investigative journalist who, you know, has his own connections with law enforcement and what have you, and other agencies in our area, and he heard that people in the district attorney's office there were lamenting and criticizing the fact that police forces, and this is maybe happening in for your listeners in your area, that police forces are getting increases in budget, right? But the district attorney's offices, the people in charge of prosecuting alleged criminals, have experienced stagnant budgets or decreases in their budgets. I explained to the journalist that it's a reflection of this time, of this period. It reflects the demise of the importance of due process and the rise of importance of law enforcement. And I think this is the beginning of a fundamental change in the course. That means the expression, you have your day in court, will begin to mean nothing.
For somebody who's just a layman, explain a little bit more about what due process ordinarily has meant in the past.
A right to an attorney. The right to be read the Miranda rights, the right to a preliminary hearing within 60 days, the right to a trial by your peers. That's due process with the passage of the USA Patriot Act. I mean, hanging over all of us now is not a fair trial. It's the military tribunal.
The changes, many of the changes that we've seen are something that, are these new or have we seen them before in the history of this country at specific times?
Some of these we've seen in specific times. Well, let's go back to the notion of the habitual offender. That concept of the repeat criminal surfaced in the 1800s, and especially after the Civil War. You know, let's say the last quarter of the 1800s, a flurry of they weren't called three strikes, but they were called habitual offender statutes, in which if an offender committed a second or third crime, the sentence will be mandatory and indeterminate. I mean, a person will not be released from jail. There is no release. In other words, there is no release date for a prisoner. I mean, there was a flurry of these statutes passed in New York and Ohio back in the 1880s. Also during that period, you had the rise. I mean, the concept of the urban police force began to take very, very concrete shape during that period. What we know as parole and probation also took shape during that period. So one can look at it and say, you know, it's the same old thing over and over again. But really it's not. Still, it's a difference. And the difference has to do with what was going on in America back then and what's going on in America today.
We're talking with Ed Owosa about the history of the criminal justice system. Ed, in this period of time in the last quarter of the 19th century, what was going on in society that caused the powers that be to want to strengthen the criminal laws at that time?
You know, I don't think it's an accident. You know, we talked about the 1994 crime bill following the LA rebellion, comparably so back in the 1880s and 1890s. It's no accident that these three strike statutes were passed, that the rise of the modern police force began to happen. It happened at a time when this country and the world, for that matter, were undergoing a tremendous change in the organization of the economy. This country was rapidly moving towards from an agrarian-based society to an urban-based society. You have the formations of what we now know today as corporations, of monopolies, and back then the rise of a bona fide third party in response to these changes. At the so-called bottom, tremendous amount of labor unrest in both rural and urban areas. I mean, the fight for the eight-hour day, the fight for fair child labor laws, tremendous upheaval. The rulers in this country had to deal with that. There's no two ways about that. They had to deal with this uprising. One way to do it, increase that police force and put into place in the courts, through the court system, programs like parole and probation. Parole, from the standpoint of those making the laws, parole was instituted because the governors in various states were only granting clemency and overturning convictions only for rich people, and poor people will still remain indeterminately in prison. Funny, we kind of have that today in California.
Many things are happening with the criminal justice system in California, including people organizing to fight against the increased construction of detention facilities. One of those struggles is taking place in Alameda County, located in California's Bay Area, where five national organizations are uniting to fight against the construction of a so-called super jail for youth.
I am Van Jones. I'm the National Executive Director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. I'm an attorney, and I am with the Books Not Bars campaign. The Books Not Bars campaign is a public education, mobilization, and advocacy campaign. We're working to fight the over-incarceration of youth, and we're also working to reverse the present fiscal trade-off between education and incarceration. And that this is definitely the first time that the five organizations, the national organizations that are online here, are all together speaking out against the proposed construction of a huge detention center in one county. All of these organizations are national organizations, very well-respected organizations. It's the first time that we've all spoken out in one voice against one project, and the reason for that is that this particular construction project in Alameda County, we think, is symptomatic and is a very compelling case study of a problem that is really affecting the state of California as a whole and really the country as a whole. And that problem is that cash-strapped counties and states that are being impacted by severe state-level budget crises are still spending hundreds of millions of dollars building huge detention centers for youth. This is despite the falling youth crime rates, despite the proof that these big detention centers do more harm than good, and it's also despite the fact that we know now through research and through careful study that there are much more cost-effective ways to bring down youth crime and youth incarceration than building these huge juvenile detention centers. The first person that we're going to hear from is Dr. Barry Crisberg. He is the president of the National Council on Crime and Delinquency.
This campaign to stop this excessively expanded detention center is being led by young people, and that's certainly a wonderful thing that we ought to pay a lot of attention to, particularly given the image that somehow our young people are not engaged in constructive and positive activities. The other thing I want to say is this is certainly a California-wide story. The legislature over the last several years has made available hundreds of millions of dollars to counties to both renovate old facilities, but also to expand capacity. And the best estimate we have is that California, which already locks up more kids per capita than any other state, is about to add another 3,000 beds to its detention stock. What this means, assuming these beds will be filled, we don't usually build facilities that aren't filled, is that collectively the counties in California will be spending an additional $175 million per year for every year to operate these new beds. So even if you leave aside the construction costs and the capital issues, even more important is at a time when we're facing a severe $25 billion budget deficit, the counties are shouldering an additional $175 million per year cost to run these things. Detention centers are basically our dumping ground where we put the kids because nobody else wants them or because it takes too much work to get them where they ought to be. Many of these young people are awaiting a group home or non-secure placement. So we're locking them up in a maximum security facility, awaiting putting them in a non-secure facility. The other thing is the plan contains no real consideration of alternatives to detention.
Kadeen Bennett is a program director with the Youth Force Coalition.
Really excited about the release of this report, especially since a lot of our opponents have labeled us as misguided youth with a lot of passion but on the wrong side. And this report clearly shows that our side has always been the right side. For the last year, we have continued to push the county to look at facts when they talk about the hall. The facts are that youth don't want the hall. Youth don't need the hall. If the county builds the hall, the county will fill it. Youth Force, in conjunction with Books Not Bars, have organized hundreds of youth who are directly affected by the hall, and we've sent a clear message to the county that we don't need a 540-bed facility. Instead, we want youth services that are community-based. We want rebuilt and expanded schools. We want job training programs. We want alternatives to detention that meet our needs. Alameda County has tried to turn a deaf ear towards us, but the youth of the Bay Area are organized, mobilized, educated, and committed to stopping the misguided expansion of the juvenile hall. We have and will continue to challenge Alameda County on all levels because our youth have been in the hall. We don't want to go back, and we know what it would take to keep us out, and Alameda County isn't doing it. We want super service, and we don't want a super jail. The Youth First Coalition and the youth of the Bay Area will continue to rally, disrupt meetings when we don't have a voice, and get the word out on the street and organize and continue to organize youth because our voices will be heard.
Van Jones.
When you talk about juvenile justice issues, people always look at young people as if they are the problem. But what we're seeing in Alameda County is the young people are actually the solution. It was the Youth First Coalition that stepped up to the plate and questioned and began to challenge this massive expenditure of money that adults, frankly, were standing by and letting it happen. So we have young people in the county who are underinvested in, who are over-incarcerated, who are actually proving themselves to be more better community members and more active and better advocates for sane policy than a lot of adults. The ability of young people to change the terms of debate is not just a local question for Alameda County. We just got news that a similar proposal to build a big youth detention facility in New York State was just scratched out of the budget at the New York State Legislature apparently yesterday because young people in New York State began to ask very hard questions with a group called the Prison Moratorium Project. So that's a huge victory on the other side of the country with young people facing a very similar issue, taking a stand and being able to get the state legislature to scratch out what was going to be another large youth detention center in New York State. So we think that, again, we should stop seeing the young people as being the problem. I think some of the decisions by adults are the problems, and we are seeing more young people actually bringing forward solutions.
Individual struggles like that in Alameda County are part of a larger battle against increased criminalization and incarceration. Correspondent Steve Miller asked private investigator Ed Owasa about these government policies.
With their proactive criminalizing of people, they're doing more than just jailing bodies and putting people in jail, even though it's in the hundreds of thousands, but they have a bigger goal, right?
We're all, as Americans, accustomed to an economy that's based on human labor. You work to earn that paycheck to buy the things you need to survive, food, shelter, etc. This is no longer true. Rulers who operate on the assumption of capitalism really then have nothing to offer. That contract is gone. It opens the gates for police states that's fledgling to evolve much more rapidly.
The elimination of human labor through the use of computers and robotics means the creation of a class of surplus and unneeded human beings. This new and permanent change in the economy is causing the ruling class to create a fascist police state ever in need of more and more jails and prisons. Ed Owasa says it's time for a change.
We have no other choice in this. Whether we like it or not, whether we want it or not, it's an objective thing that all of us are being faced with right now. This vision has to deal with the creation, the development of a society that will adequately shelter and clothe all of us. And when I think of a vision that talks about reorganizing society, I think it's much more than that. You know, you think of the types of crimes that are occurring now in the world. A new vision and a new organization also has to deal with how we treat each other. Schoolyard shootings. Now, parents killing kids. I mean, it's this thing about Catholic priests. It just goes on and on and on. I mean, a lot of these things seem to me, biblical in truly epical times. And I just as much as we, I'm arguing that these new laws are a reflection of a changing economy, but these astoundingly horrendous criminal acts are also reflective of that, of this changing and declining economy. We all have to have faith in really workers in this country to respond to this.
Critics often claim that the type of cooperative society that Owasa and others are advocating for is some sort of utopian pipe dream. They say human beings are too greedy and self-centered. Ed Owasa believes differently.
This particular witness, who had information about mistaken identity, we might be able to show in court that the victim in a certain case identified somebody mistakenly. Simple as that. This fellow was hiding from me. I looked high and low in this particular neighborhood, I can't tell you where, and I spoke to his mother. And I told his mother, your son is the only person in this whole world who has information about this, about a mistaken identity. That son, who had just come out of prison, he's been in and out, he's been around the block several times. When he heard that, he came out of the garage. But for 5 days, he was hiding because he did not want to be drawn into this. People will respond on the basis of morality.
Ed Owasa is a private investigator who works in California's Bay Area. He was interviewed by People's Tribune Radio correspondent Steve Miller. You're listening to People's Tribune Radio. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We'll be back after this brief break for station identification. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. Guillermo Gomez Pena is a writer, political commentator, and performance artist. He also joins us from California's Bay Area.
I'm an interdisciplinary artist. I've written 5 books. The latest one is called Dangerous Border Crossers, and it was published by Routledge Press last year. I also do solo performance pieces and large-scale performance pieces with my troupe. I have a troupe of kind of like rebel artists from different racial communities, you know, ethnic backgrounds, and, you know, professional métiers. I write for newspapers in Mexico, and I also do what I term, you know, conceptual radio or radical radio as much as I can. And basically, I am part of the larger Chicano community. I am currently living in San Francisco with my beloved wife, Colombian arts organizer and writer Carolina Ponce de Leon, who directs the Galería de la Raza. And we can be contacted through Pocha Nostra, which is our small but extremely active organization here in the Mission. And the telephone number is 415-701-7385.
Among your numerous talents and endeavors, one of them that we haven't talked about is your role as a commentator on National Public Radio. We're moving into a new millennium. I was wondering what your thoughts might be on looking forward to where we might be going.
Well, I think that there is a lot of causes for worry. I am extremely worried about the much touted global project, which is not that global. In fact, it is a project invented by a handful of wealthy northern and western countries. And in this project, the roles assigned for the southern hemisphere are reduced to those of passive consumers, raw matter, or criminal economies. I am extremely worried about the utopian rhetoric of free trade, the rhetoric of NAFTA and the upcoming FTAA, which essentially wants open borders from north to south and closed borders from south to north. And it essentially wants the free exchange of consumer goods, capital, and hallowed dreams, and certainly not of human beings and ideas. I think that these are the great subject matters of our times, and as an artist, I'm totally devoted to explore them, to analyze them, to articulate them, and to present hopefully more enlightened models of relationship between North and South.
I'm curious what your thoughts are about rappers and the hip-hop culture as a vehicle for exploring the types of issues that you just said were so important.
We regularly work with rappers. I'm just about to print a CD with a Mexican musician, Guillermo Galindo, and we utilize rappers, as well as opera singers, rockers, and mariachis, ¿verdad? But we are totally committed to figuring out ways to connect to, or reconnect with the younger generations. You know, I feel that we have abandoned them, and it is our responsibility to reconnect with them.
It seems that no matter what issue one's talking about, if one really wants to get that issue across somehow, it comes down to organizing and having a message that resonates with people and a clear message. I don't know that I can think of any group in the latter half of the last century, certainly in the last decade, that has been more successful with that than the Zapatistas. I was wondering about your thoughts on that.
I think that the great lesson of the Zapatistas was a very pertinent definition of democracy. Democracy in Mexico, as in any other society, can only exist if we first acknowledge and then incorporate its forbidden diversity, which in the words of Subcomandante Marcos includes not just the indigenous peoples, but also women, gays, and even those on the other side of the mirror, the Chicanos and the undocumented Mexicans. All countries can learn from Zapatismo. You know. In the year 2001, monolithic visions of nation are being confronted by one of multiplicity, hybridity, tolerance, and these visions are emanating directly from the border wound. I think that if we don't get hip to the idea of including the other in the negotiating table, and by the way, the other is no longer as other as we think it is, if we don't engage in a conversation with our upside-down reflection in the mirror, with our evil twin, we're going to be in deep shit.
Writer, commentator, performance artist, and activist Guillermo Gomez Pena. My name is Mike Thornton, your host for People's Tribune Radio. We invite you to stay tuned now for the performance art of Guillermo Gomez Pena.
Criminal identity profile. Complete name, Guillermo Lino Gomez Pena. English translation, Guermo, Guillermo, Williermo, Gomez Pines, or Pena. Nationality, since 1999, dual, Mexican and USian. Self-identity, transgenic Mexican in process of Chicanoization. Race, genetically engineered mestizo. Languages spoken fluently, Spanish, English, Spanglish, Gringoñol, Franglais, Robo Esperanto, and fake Nahuatl. Distinguishing features, performance scars on both arms, stomach, and right knee, Pinto tattoos on chest, right arm, and left shoulder, Chicano astigmatas on my back, hyper-Mexican mustache, loungy sideburns, melancholic gaze. Occupations, performance artist, writer, videoasta, journalist, activist, borderologo, reversed anthropologist, experimental linguist, media pirate, bad actor, Latino consumer service representative of the U.S. art world, and understudy for Mr. Antonio Banderas. Main performance aliases, in chronological order, Mr. Misterio, El Existentialist Mojado, Border Brujo, El Warrior for Gringos Troika, El Untranslatable Vato, El Mariachi Liberace, El Aztec High-Tech, El Nafta Azteca, El Mad Mex, El Mexterminator, Information Superhighway Bandito, and El Web Back. Weapons used to fight back. Language, spoken and written, live performance, radio, the internet, theatricalized madness, humor, strategic silence, and the Mexican survival kit. Contents, fake press cards, assorted chiles, hangover relief medicine, makeup, shamanic artifacts of sorts, and a mariachi hat to look friendly. Favorite places where I have performed. Correctional facilities, museums of natural history, a karaoke bar in Helsinki, a 17th century convent in Mexico City, a town hall in New England, the Royal British Theater, and a cyber trade convention in Los Angeles. I fly back to the U.S. a few days after Black Tuesday, the sad April 1st of 96 when the new anti-immigration legislation came into effect. Remember? It's Thursday night at a hectic Los Angeles airport. As I wait for my luggage, I am sniffed by two humongous police dogs. A border guard approaches me. No big deal. I always get stopped because I've been told I just have this archetypal suspicious look, a cross between a border dandy and a generic Latino outlaw.
Excuse me, sir, where are you coming from?
Mexico City, I reply.
Why? He asks.
What do you mean? Why Mexico City as opposed to Hong Kong? Or why am I coming back? Because since I live here in California, I am condemned to always come back. He finds no humor in my logic, and no logic in my humor.
What do you do? He asks.
I'm a performance artist. What the hell is that? I begin to imagine the possible answers. You know, officer, in the early 90s, during the Counter Colombo celebrations, I did this project with a colleague, an experimental ethnographic project. We exhibited ourselves in natural history museums for three-day periods inside a gilded cage, as undiscovered Amerindians from the fictional island of Watinawi. So, what do you do? He asks. You mean you want me to describe my aesthetics and cosmology? Or are you simply implying I am lying to you? He is now visibly upset and demands to see an ID. I show him an art press card.
So, what are you writing about?
Crossing borders, U.S.-Mexico relations, immigration, situations like this one. He pauses and then continues more aggressively.
So what do you think about your country's government being so involved with those big-time drug dealers from Juarez?
It's bad, I say. But what about the fact that there is evidence to suspect that the drugs coming from the Contras a decade ago were introduced to communities of color via the Los Angeles Police Department? He takes a step back.
Where did you get that crap?
It was international news last year, I reply.
But nowadays drugs are mainly coming from Mexico.
His insistence in demonizing Mexico really sets me off. Sure, I answer, precisely because there is a market here in America. Or are you so naive as to think that the production of drugs creates the market? He doesn't get my point, neither do I. Instead, he writes a mysterious note and sends me to secondary inspection where I spend the next 2 hours watching a bored customs agent inspecting every inch of my suitcases, including toiletries, props, costumes, performance scripts, my phone agenda, and all because of my big mouth and my thick mustache. Since he didn't find the confirmation of his fears, he took my green card away. So I decided to apply for the gold one. So as a performance artist, what do I do with incidents like this one? I turn the epistemological table 180 degrees and become a border patrolman. So dear radio listener, I would like to ask you some basic questions which are at the core of American identity. How many of you out there in radio land consider yourselves pure-blooded whites? What about people of color? Any Native Americans? Chicanos? African Americans? Are there any quote-unquote illegal immigrants in radio land right now? People who once were illegal, perhaps? What about people who married an illegal alien to help them get their green card? Hey, that's transnational solidarity. Any people who have hired undocumented migrants for domestic or artistic purposes? Oh yeah? To do what exactly? How much did you pay them? Thanks for your sincerity. Now, let's get a bit more personal. People who have had sex with an illegal alien. See? That's political. What about sex with an alien? I mean, abduction. Can you please describe their genitalia in detail? Now, on a different subject matter, intercultural fetishes. Have any of you ever fantasized about being from another race or culture? Which one? Black? Indian? Mexican? Thanks for your candor and sincerity, dear listener. Now, let's reverse the gaze. Would anyone like to ask me a question? Any question, as irreverent or indiscreet as it may be? Please call the phone number of People's Tribune Radio right now.
This is People's Tribune Radio, and our guest is writer and performance artist Guillermo Gomez Peña.
Fear. You know, America is the land of irrational fear. We're all suffused in a culture of fear, fear of difference, and yet we love it. This is perhaps what separates us from the rest of the world. But then, to bridge this gap, we import cultural fear to the rest of the world. Nowadays, even Russians are afraid of Mexicans because we look like gypsies or Mongolians. It's sweet. Wait, do you hear the police sirens? Beautiful, que no? America. What a beautifully scary place to be. But then living in fear is normal for us. We're all scared shitless of the immediate future. The 21st century, que trip, que chorizo. By the way, are you scared of me? Of my accent, my strange intelligence? My obnoxious capability to articulate your fears? An articulate Mexican can be scarier than a gang member, que no? So after the show, my colleagues and I get pulled over by the cops because we are still wearing our Mexterminator regalia and makeup. Tell me, officer, le digo al Chota, what exactly are you scared of? My unpredictable behavior, my poetic tarantula, my acid politics, my criminal tendencies, my tropical diseases, my alleged ancient wisdom. My shamanic ability to exorcise the evil out of white people. Yes or no? Que sí, que no, que tú, que yo. Because I am scared of you. Of your silence, pinche mustio. Your silence makes you really scary. And the distance between you and I, the distance makes it even worse. We spend the night in jail. Brownout.
This is People's Tribune Radio.
The third party Chicano candidate addresses the Brown House. Dear Chicanos and honorary Chicanos y todos los demás, the historical mission of the U.S. is to put the world at risk and then to save it from the very risks they created. For example, to arm other countries and then to attack them for being armed. To provide weapons and drugs to the youth of color and then to imprison them for using them. To endanger species and then to raise consciousness and create programs to save them. To evict the poor and then punish them from living on the streets. To turn women and people of color into freaks and then laugh at us for acting out like freaks. The historical mission of the U.S. is very, very peculiar. Republicans see it as a divine mission, a historical mandate. Democrats call it the most perfect democracy on earth. Dear audience, if I were a politician, would you vote for me? Despite my outlaw looks, my obvious biases, despite my lack of theatrical training, if this was, say, a presidential campaign and not a performance art piece, what would I say? What should I say? Imaginary political speech number 5.
Dear citizens of the Millennial Barrio, We are now faced with a very serious dilemma. We have entered the post-democratic phase of advanced capitalism, and there is simply no return. In this era of savage globalization, we politicians have total disregard for human pain. For the homeless, the newly arrived immigrants, our elders, our children and teens, the artists, the infirmed, the crazy ones like you. We have gotten used to living without seeing, without sharing. For the moment, all we share is the moment.
No, that's a bad phrase.
For the moment, the only thing we share is time.
No, there is no way out of this sentence. I'm going to try imaginary political speech number 7.
Dear orphans of the nation state, we now live in a fully borderized and fragmented world composed of virtual nations, transnational pop cultures, and hybrid races.
Hey, that's a great line.
And all we share is fear and vertigo, fear of the future, of love, of disease, of loneliness, of total disenfranchisement, and vertigo, the feeling of standing on the edge of a new millennium, yes, pure horror, vacui, Y2K, Ike, Apocalypse Mañana!
Apocalypse Mañana, hey, that's a poem on itself.
We feel it in our crotch. It goes up our spine and into our throat and out of our nostrils and eyes. And it's fucking unbearable.
No. Sorry, I'm overdoing it, I know. But I just don't see any other way to make my point. Wait. There might be another way. A joint. Imaginary political speech number 12. Dear American citizen, if you vote for me, I can assure you that as the first Mexican president of the U.S., I will fulfill your fears and desires like no other politician ever did. And all your stereotypes will come true, carnal. I will open all borders, legalize drugs, make daily sex mandatory, make Spanglish the official language, expropriate TV stations and hand them over to performance artists, create new university campuses, abolish altogether the police force, ban all weapons from handguns to missiles, deport Bush back to Texas and Gore back to Epcot, Florida. Feels great to imagine, Keno. So, I am addressing the Brown House. Chido. I'm exercising my political imagination. Chidissimo. One objective of performance art is to exercise the freedoms and imagination which have been denied to us by the government. But then there is reality. Just as politicians are bad performance artists, artists make lousy politicians. And you know why? Because we're lousy liars. And when we lie, we overdo it just to make a point.
This is People's Tribune Radio. Our very special guest is Guillermo Gomez Peña.
I politely ask the listener to close your eyes and imagine a faraway country controlled by far-right politicians in their 60s and 70s. They ignore that the Cold War is over. They are supported by religious fundamentalists and gun manufacturers. Just imagine. Among other dated ideas, these guys believe, or rather pretend to believe, that the liberal media and the experimental art have thoroughly destroyed our social fabric, our moral and family values, and they are determined to restore them at any cost. As part of their great project of moral restoration, they have decided to carefully scrutinize everything that goes on radio, TV, and printed journalism, including this very so from to sitcoms, and from news to programming, they have digital sensors which can detect keywords that trigger ideological or cultural difference. Since it is practically impossible to monitor everything, they have devised a mechanism via which the syntactic and conceptual coherence of a thought is, especially when dealing with conflicting opinions. So when it comes to, say, sexuality, most explicit words have been, and I mean just words such as or. In politics, things are not that different. In order to ensure that Tende information does not pollute the minds of true American patriots like you, they have forbidding the use of terminology like or, cop, or, even an innocent term like. In a world such as this, content would be restricted to, and the possibility to make intelligent civic choices would be affecting our funda to. Imagine what kind of a world this would be. For the moment, all we have left is our imagination.
Writer, performance artist, and next Terminator, Guillermo Gomez Peña. That's it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same tools of computerization and robotics that are being used to displace millions of workers worldwide are used instead for the benefit of humanity as a whole. If you'd like more information about the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, you can contact us by calling 1-800-691-6888. 1-800-691-6888 or on the internet at www.lrna.org. We'd like to thank you for listening to the program today and send out thanks to the radio stations around the world that air People's Tribune Radio. With the newly implemented changes at the FBI and the likely effect those will have on civil liberties and political repression, it's more important than ever to support independent radio. We encourage you to do so. We are undoubtedly at a critical juncture, and despite what Mr. Mueller and Attorney General John Ashcroft may think, the future is really up to us. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.